The Bible school theme is the kingdoms of this world are become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ. Our speaking brother, Steve Hornhart, his title, Behold, I Come, Blessed is He That Watcheth. The subtitle for this fifth talk is True and Righteous Are Thy Judgments, reading from Revelations 11, verse 11 to 19. Brother Steve.
Well, thank you, Brother Roger, and good morning, brethren and sisters in my Lord, in our Lord Jesus Christ. It's nice to be with you again as we commence our fifth study under the general theme, Behold, I Come Quickly, Blessed is He That Watcheth, and the particular title this morning is True and Righteous Are Thy Judgments. Now, just by way of connecting link, brothers and sisters, before we get started in this, in the detail of the second part of chapter 11 and then swing into, well, I guess a brief overview, it will have to be this morning, of the first five vials of Revelation 16. Just by way of a connection, you'll note that in verse 14 of Revelation 11, the second woe is past, and behold, the third woe cometh quickly. Now we remember that when we had a look at the second half of Revelation 9, that was the first part of the second woe. We had that chapter 10, which broke the first half of the second woe and the second half of the second woe. And here we are in Revelation 11, picking up now the second part of what was finished off at the end of chapter 9. That's why we read in verse 14, the second woe is past, having already started in chapter 9. Now, what you need to do if you're connecting the theme or the thread of this particular part of the apocalypse is that when you finish reading verse 14, you then should, to pick up the threads, flick across to Revelation 16 and then start reading and beginning from chapter verse 1 of Revelation 16. So when it says the second woe is past and behold the third woe cometh quickly, well, there is the detail in Revelation 16 and verse 1, and it then sweeps you through the third woe. However, what Revelation 11 does in verses 15 to 19, it gives us a very broad overview of the third woe. Just a snapshot, if you like, large detail, and the detail of this verse 15, the seventh angel sounded. You've got a broad overview, but the detail of the seventh angel sounding, as we've said a minute ago, is picked up as you then begin verse 1 and work your way through Revelation 16. That's how just the threads are connected in a big picture format. So the second woe finishes, behold, the third woe cometh quickly, a snapshot and an overview in the latter part of Revelation 11, and the detail of that snapshot is picked up from verse 1 onwards through Revelation chapter 16. Now, we looked at, we had to make a decision, didn't we? We had to make a decision that, what do? Do we finish off Revelation 11? Or we sort of forget the last half of that and just sort of launch into some detail of Revelation 16? Well, we made the decision last night and we thought, we'll finish off Revelation 11 and do a very brief overview of Revelation 16, the first five vials. We'll see how we go. We did say yesterday, brothers and sisters, didn't we, that when we looked at Revelation 11, the chapter had three players. We had the saints, we had the two witnesses, and we had the beast of the sea, Catholicism. So the saints were the altar, the temple and the holy city, the two witnesses, the two olive trees, the two lampstands, the two prophets, same group but given different titles. They were your anti-papal witnesses. They were political witnesses on one hand, and they were religious witnesses on the other, and they were standing against the God of the earth, and they would witness for 1260 years. So we finished off yesterday morning with that chart, and we got that far with the chart. We did say, didn't we? Now, with respect to the witnesses, of course, the time period for the measuring with that rod, that rabdos, that rod of correction for the ecclesia, for the saints, for the temple, the holy city, and the altar, that would be 42 months. And that began in 608 to 610, and would finish in 1870. That was the ecclesia. But we're looking at the witnesses when they would begin to sound out against the Catholic system, the beast of the sea. And that started in 312 when Constantine made the world religious, Catholicism, and the woman split and fled to the northern part of Africa, and we saw about the Donatists and the Circumcilians. That's when was when the political and the religious witnessing started. And they were then witnessed for 1,260 years. But then in Revelation 11, it says that there would be a ceasing of their witnessing. And we talked about 1572, which was the massacre of St. Bartholomew's Day. And this, now we need to note this, brothers and sisters, very carefully. The slaying of the witnesses began in 1572 and continued with intensity until finally in 1685, the climax, if you like, the consummation of the death of the witnesses, where they would be politically gagged. No more would they sound out. So you need to get that. You'll see that when we start looking in a moment about this little time period from 1685 through to the French Revolution. So we get that very firmly in our mind, that the slaying of the witnesses began when 71,000 Huguenots were slain, both on the night of the wedding of Henry of Navarre and the months that ensued. 3,000 on the wedding night of Henry, and then 68,000 Huguenots, the Protestants, the hub of the Protestants of Europe, if you like, but these were the Protestants in France. Well, we then said, didn't we, that a number of years later, Henry of Navarre, who was married in 1572 on the night that they slew those 3,000 Huguenots, in 1598, he then became, through circumstances, the King of France. And of course, to favour the Catholics, he became a Catholic, but he was a Huguenot leader. And therefore, he had to placate the Catholics by becoming a Catholic, but of course, also he had to do something for his Huguenots, and so he decreed an edict where religious freedom would be given to the Huguenots. But that did not last, because as time went on, Louis XIII grew agitative, and Louis XIII wanted the edict to be removed, but he wasn't powerful enough. It came through King Louis XIV in 1685, when he was strong enough and had enough support whereby he would revoke what was instituted by Henry of Navarre. So he revoked this edict, and this became a milestone in history, and the witnesses now would suffer extreme political death. And we pick that up in Revelation 11 and verses 7 to 9, where the witnesses would die and their dead bodies would remain in the street. Now let's read that, verses 7 through to 9 of Revelation chapter 11. So this was Revelation 11, verses 7 to 9. This was 1685. This is the consummation of the slaying of the witnesses that had already began in 1572. So we pick up the reading and read from verse 7. And when they shall have finished their testimony, the beast, the Catholic system, that ascendeth out of the abyss, Europe, shall make war against them and kill them and overcome them. Began in 1572 and now here culminates in 1685, because in verse 8 is really 1685, where their dead bodies would lie in the street of the great city which is spiritually called Sodom and Egypt, where also our Lord was crucified, and they of the people and kindreds and tongues and nations shall see their dead bodies 3 days and a half, and shall not suffer their dead bodies to be put in graves. That was the revocation of the Edict of Nantes. Now, brothers and sisters, we did say, didn't we, when we'll just flick across there. Let's have a look at verse 8, because I think verse 8 is a very important verse with respect to their dead bodies. In a moment, I want to have a look at this, probably the most complicated, the most challenging time period in the book of Revelation would have to be the dead bodies laying in the street for 3.5 days. So I look out on the audience and I see faces that look reasonably alert. I feel sorry for Brother Ken. He's got the afternoon session, but mind you, I've got the teenagers, so let that be a lesson to you, Brother Ken. So you really need to be very, very with it when we come to have a look at the most challenging time period in the apocalypse, which is 3.5 days. Before we look at that, we need to get our head around, first of all, verse 8, and find out who or what is the great city. Why is it called spiritually Sodom and Egypt? Why is it said that this great city was where our Lord was crucified? And we need to identify the street in this great city. So in this one verse, there is packed a lot of information. Let's have a look at this verse, and then we'll then go back and see these dead bodies laying in this street, which is identified in verse 8, for 3.5 days. All right, on the screen there, we have their dead bodies. This was the death of the witnesses, and they would lie in the street of the great city. Let's first of all, brothers and sisters, identify the great city. The great city is no doubt clearly Rome. We have these three quotations, Revelation 14, verse 8, Revelation 16, verse 9, and Revelation 17, verse 18. So did I say 16, verse 9? 16, verse 19, and 17, verse 18. Let's just turn back one of those references in Revelation 17, verse 18, clearly establishing that this great city is Rome. That brings a problem. What's Rome got to do with Paris or France? Well, we'll see how this pans out in a moment. Now, Revelation chapter 17 and verse 18. Many of you will be very, very well aware of this verse and the context. John, of course, saw the great whore or the harlot sitting upon the scarlet-coloured beast with 7 heads and 10 horns. He didn't know what it was. He said verse 9 will do. Here is the mind which hath wisdom. The 7 heads are 7 mountains on which the woman sitteth. And so John is given a list of details to identify what this beast was and who the woman was. Well, there's the verse I was looking for, verse 6. And I saw the woman drunken with the blood of saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. And when I saw her, I was astonished. That's as it is in the Greek. I was astonished. I did not know what this was. This great woman with a golden cup, with the name stamped in her head, Mystery Babylon the Great, Mother of Harlots. And the angel said, in verse 9, here is the mind which hath wisdom. And then gives John political and geographical evidence to show who the beast was and who the woman was. However, it culminates in verse 18, where simply the woman which thou sawest is that great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. So it's Rome. So when we have a look at Revelation chapter 11 and verse 8, this great city is Rome. Now, the problem is, brothers and sisters, is we've got a street in Rome. Now, the street, as we'll see in a moment, is France. But this quotation that we've taken from the emperor, the pagan Roman emperor Caracalla, who was one of the emperors, in fact, he was the first emperor of the third seal in Revelation 6. And the third seal in Revelation chapter 6 was the black horse. And the black horse in the pagan Roman Empire was particularly and peculiarly singled out for taxation. The balances in the black horse, the Roman Empire, the badge of the rider of the black horse was a pair of balances. And it was injustice. There was total injustice at that period. And they taxed like you wouldn't believe. And Caracalla was a tax madman. He taxed anything. He said, if you were standing still, you'd be taxed for taking up space. Now, what Caracalla did was he wanted to bring as much money in to pay for his luxurious lifestyle and to buy off his army. What he did, he said, you're all citizens of Rome. Oh, but those who lived out in the provinces, no, we don't live in Rome. He said, yes, you do. He said, I've now made the borders of the empire the city. So there's a quotation. He said, the frontiers of this empire are the limits of the city of Rome, so that doesn't matter where you live in the Roman Empire, I'm going to tax you because you are a citizen of Rome. So when you therefore look at the apocalypse and look at this particular verse, when it says the great city, which is Rome, we're talking about the Roman Empire, the whole area of Europe that Rome occupied. Therefore, the dead bodies that lay in the, not the street, but they lay in the broad place, the plateau. So France was a broad street, a plateau, in this empire or in this large area of Europe. In fact, France was Papal Rome's special protector and principal thoroughfare of the great city spiritually called Babylon. And France, brothers and sisters, was the eldest son of the church. It were the Franks were the first ones to adopt Catholicism. So when it says the great city, Rome, we're talking about the whole area of Europe, and in this great city, as Caracalla had pinpointed the borders, there is a large thoroughfare, not just a little lane, not just a little street. France was a large area that embraced, supported, and carried on the spirit of Catholicism. And it's in that broad plateau that these things would happen, that these dead bodies would, of course they would. Now Rome, it says, now when we have a look, at it says here that the great city would be Rome. That's why, brothers and sisters, when you read verse 13, the answer is there for us. Because in verse 13 of this chapter, chapter 11, it says this. And the same hour there was a great earthquake. And the tenth part of the city fell. The great earthquake was the French Revolution. So can you see how that fits? The tenth part of Europe, the borders of which Caracalla said is Rome, the tenth part. Well, there are your 10 toes of Nebuchadnezzar's image. There are the 10 horns of the beast of Revelation 17. This was the Europe with which was broken up into 10 barbaric areas, and one of them was the Franks. So here we have a tenth part of those 10 parts of Europe that falls. What a remarkable thing. The tenth part of the city fell, which was France. Now when these witnesses were slain in the broad plateau of the great city, this broad plateau which was France, the record then goes on to say, brothers and sisters, that they would lay in the street for 3.5 days. Where they were killed was where they would come back to life again. They were slain in France. They would come back to life in France. So their coming back to life would be the great shaking of the people. It would be the French Revolution. It would be the second great earthquake of the apocalypse. But the record says their bodies would lay in the street for 3.5 days. Now, I've got up there that the 3.5 days was literally, historically, 105 years. Now, how do we get 3.5 days equating to 105 years? Because when the Edict of Nantes was revoked, and the political death where they had 15 days to get out of France if they didn't get converted to Catholicism, said Louis XIV. When that happened, they were politically gagged, no longer able to speak out, and they remained silent, these witnesses, silent, until the French Revolution when they stood on their feet, which was 1789. It was a period, literally, of 105 years. How do we get 3.5 days equaling 105 years on the day for a year principle in the apocalypse? This is a challenging time period. Can it be reconciled? Absolutely. This is how we come to look at the 105 years coming from 3.5 days. Now these witnesses, the death of these witnesses, they would die politically, unable anymore to speak out. They were gagged by Louis XIV. 3.5 days later, they were raised politically. They became a political entity. Of course they did. They kicked out the aristocracy and they gagged the papacy. So they would politically rise with a great voice in the French Revolution. Now, 3.5 days, we say, equals 105 years. The bodies remained in a state of non-decay. So this is what John sees. He sees these bodies laying in the street. And people are sort of walking all around the place in France and they can see the dead bodies. They remain there. They weren't picked to pieces by birds. They weren't ravaged by beasts. They stayed there, pristine, if I can call the dead body pristine, but they stayed there, and everyone walked by, and they could still see them. They were still in existence, ready to come back to life again. Now, we know in the apocalypse, in some of the time periods that we've looked at, like 5 months with the locusts, 1,260 days with the witnesses, a day for a year. We know that through the apocalypse, a day for a year is the principle. But if in this case we apply the direct day for a year principle, it would mean that the bodies would have to remain in the street for 105 days. So we should read, and the dead bodies remained in the street for 105 days, and after 105 days, the bodies came back to life again. But brothers and sisters, there is a thing in the apocalypse called the decorum of the symbol. And the decorum of the symbol means that God squeezes, he reduces zip files for those people who are into technology. God just zips and zips a time period and says that is appropriate decorum. You can't have bodies laying in the street for 105 days and still be seen in the same state that they were when they went down. It would not fit the decorum. I'll give you an example. Before I explain how the 105 days gets there, let's come back to Revelation chapter 8 and verse 1, just to show you what the decorum of the symbol means. Like, we have beasts that roam, and they roam for 1,260 days. You can have a beast that's alive for 3.5 years, literally. That fits a decorum. You can't have a beast running around for 1,260 years. It doesn't fit the decorum. Now, when you have a look at Revelation chapter 8 and verse 1, here's a classic example. When he had opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for about the space of a half an hour. Now, brothers and sisters, Revelation 8 verse 1 shows us the end of the sixth seal, which was the great earthquake when paganism was removed, taken from Revelation chapter 6. And then what happened is Constantine came in, and there was a time of tranquility and peace. So John says, I saw in the political heavens silence for about the space of a half an hour. I can only just tell you this. If you want to talk to me about this, we will spend 15 minutes or so. This half an hour here was 14 years. It was the period from the time Constantine came in and took the whole empire in AD 324 until Constantine died in AD 337. So 324 through to AD 337, there was political stability. All the time leading up to Constantine, there was war in heaven, Revelation 12. War in heaven, war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon, that old serpent, the devil. And Constantine fought against paganism until finally Constantine overthrew paganism. And then in 324 AD, there was political tranquility. Until Constantine died in 337. And then there was chaos back again. 14 years. Now the record says there was silence in heaven for about the space of a half an hour. You couldn't have John standing there and listening for half an hour. Well, you couldn't have John standing there listening for 14 days. 14 days, 14 years. So there is this thing called the decorum of the symbol. You might want to just jot those notes down there. It would take some more explaining to get that if that's the first time you've heard that. But whenever you read there was an earthquake for an hour, for instance, in Revelation chapter 11, it's 30 years. There's a decorum. 1 hour is a twelfth of a day. 1 month is a twelfth of a year. Let's just flip back to Revelation 11 and see that 1 hour of the earthquake, just to show you how God uses a decorum. Verse 13 of Revelation 11. The same hour there was a great earthquake. And so with the French Revolution and the events that followed, God says it would be an hour. You can have an earthquake for an hour and the aftershocks. This is a period of 30 years. Day for a year principle. 1 hour is a twelfth of a day. 1 month is a twelfth of a year. There are 30 days in a month. 30 days equals 30 years. Do you see what God's doing? He says, I put down there things that match a decorum. So here, brothers and sisters, we have these dead bodies laying in the street for 3.5 days. How do we reconcile it? to fit the historical, because there is no doubt from the time the Edict of Nantes was revoked until the French Revolution, those dead bodies were laying there. This is how we reconcile. The decorum of the symbol requires another solution. These days, brothers and sisters, are lunar days. And what that means is this. We have our Earth, and our Earth revolves on its axis once every 24 hours. We have a moon. Now, of course, the moon is a symbol in the scriptures as the ecclesia. It waxes and it wanes, or a symbol of ecclesiastical powers. But we've got the Earth that revolves on its axis every 24 hours. We've got the moon, and the moon does not revolve on its axis, but rather the moon revolves around the Earth once every 30 days. So here's the moon. Around the Earth it goes. Once there's 30 days. That's a lunar day. It goes around the Earth again. That's 60 days. Two lunar days. It goes around the Earth the third time. That's 90 days. It goes around the Earth a half a day, which is 15. That is 105 of our days, which is 105 years. That fits the decorum. God could not say, and he doesn't. There are a number of passages in the Apocalypse. He does not just use the straight day for a year. He says it doesn't fit the decorum. You can't have an earthquake for 30 days or 30 years or a month. And you can't have dead bodies laying in the street. So that's our reconciliation here. There's the summary. One lunar day is 30 of our days. 3.5 lunar days, or revolvings of the moon around the earth, multiplied by 30 is 105 days, and 105 days is 105 years. Exactly from the revocation of the Edict of Nantes, when the witnesses were gagged politically, and then they would remain in that state until they would stand on their feet exactly 105 years later. Now, I want to show you something with respect to history, brothers and sisters. Have a look at this. Here is Belloc in the French Revolution, the book The French Revolution, page 231. He says this. He says, the Huguenots, who were slain in 1685 and ceased to witness, they were told to get out of France, and they remained there for 105 years, this historian says, who wasn't reading the Apocalypse, he says, though no longer permitted to exist as a state within a state, remained for the 100 years between the revocation of the Edict of Nantes there and the outbreak of the French Revolution, a powerful and ever watchful body. They were there, brothers and sisters. You could see their dead bodies. They hadn't corrupted. That's the point. That's why God says they didn't corrupt. You could still see them. They were a powerful, ever watchful body, but they were gagged. It wasn't until the French Revolution came that they stood on their feet, a mighty army. Now have a look at this. This is an interesting little quote here. You read, when they were slain, the record says in verse 9, because verse 7 says they were overcome and killed and their dead bodies would remain in France. Now when you read verse 9, an interesting little verse, it says, and they of the people and kindreds and tongues and nations shall see their dead bodies 3.5 days, that's the 105 years, and shall not suffer their dead bodies to be put in graves. In other words, someone in verse 9 who were called they of the people, kindreds and tongues and nations, someone said they're not going to be buried. They've been killed by Louis XIV and his cronies. But somebody said there, we're not going to allow them to be buried. And that somebody that said they're not going to be allowed to be buried are those who were called peoples, nations, and tongues. They were the Protestant nations or the Protestant countries outside of France. And they allowed refuge. So these people who were being slain fled to the perimeters of France, to the other Protestant nations, and they did not allow them to be totally obliterated, because one day God said, in 105 years, in 3.5 apocalyptic days, they're going to come back to life. Isn't that amazing? So there in verse 9, they of the people, these are the Protestant nations outside of France, did not let them be buried forever. They protected them, they gave them succor, they allowed them to stay there until one day they'd come back, in verse 11, when the spirit of life entered into them and there'd be a mighty revolution. Well, there's a train coming, brothers and sisters. 105 years they've been gagged politically. 105 years they've been under the thumb of the beast of the earth, of the beast, the Catholic, the beast that came out of the abyss. And therefore in Revelation 11 and verses 11 to 13, we have now the French Revolution, the end of the 105 days. So we pick up the record and we read in verse 11 that after 3 days and a half, after the 105 days, three and a half lunar days, 105 years, the spirit of life from God entered into them and they stood on their feet in the broad plateau, that is the street of the great city in France. They stood where they were killed and great fear fell upon them which saw them. Of course they did. This expression, great fear, fell upon them which saw them. Well, who were they? Well, they, brothers and sisters, were those who rejoiced when they had killed them. Verse 10, and they that dwell upon the earth shall rejoice over them. You remember when we saw the coin struck by Pope Gregory the 13th, who struck a coin and said, when we slew the Huguenots, when we put them to death, we made merry, we had a party. Well, they were rejoicing in verse 10, but here, brothers and sisters, in verse 11, they are fearful. So the Catholics are fearful because they can see this great train coming down the track. They can hear this rumble of a French Revolution. And brothers and sisters, in 1789, this is what took place in France. In 1789, this was the standing up again of the witnesses. And there we have, in 1789, we have the assembled parliament in France. And up there we have King Louis the 16th, circled up there. He, brothers and sisters, King Louis the 16th, he is in trouble. He's in big trouble, was Louis the 16th in 1789. The record in verse 12 of Revelation chapter 11 says this with respect to Louis the 16th's problem. It says here in verse 12, and they heard a great voice from heaven, saying unto them, come up hither, and they ascended up to heaven in a cloud, and their enemies beheld them. And the same hour was the French Revolution, where the tenth part, France, fell. Now this heaven, brothers and sisters, is the political heaven of France. And there's a great voice that came from those who headed over the political arena in France. And Louis the 16th said, I'm in trouble. And so what he did, he says, come up and assemble in the parliament. And he called all of these people in a great cloud. He said, I've got to get you together. We've got to work this out. We've got a problem. And his problem was, brothers and sisters, quite frankly, France was broke. It was broke. And so he assembled his parliament together, which had been previously established in 1302, and they called it the Estates General. It was the French legislative body that was comprised of three groups, or estates of society. They had the clergy, they had the nobility, and they had the commoners. And he called them all together. Now, before I talk about the clergy and the nobility and the commoners, and tell you how they used to vote, and to tell you what Louis did that was different here in 1789 and why it says, he says, come up, and they ascended in a great, great cloud. Just tell you about Louis the 16th, brothers and sisters. He was in trouble. And so what he did, he got a Swiss financial advisor. And he called him in and he said, I'm in trouble. And the Swiss financial advisor says, what's your problem? He said, I'm broke. No money. He said, what can you do to help me? And so the Swiss financial advisor said to him, there are two issues. Stop spending, or there'll be a revolution. And so Louis went to his wife, as you would. And he said to his wife, whose name was Marie Antoinette, he said, I just asked my financial advisor, what should I do? And he told me to stop spending. What do you think? And she said, sack him. And he did. And there was a revolution. I mean, brothers and sisters, Marie Antoinette, so out of touch with reality. The story goes, many of you would know, the word came to her that the people were starving. They had no bread. Her response was, well, if there's no bread, give them cake. And they had a nickname for Marie Antoinette. Her nickname was Madame Deficit, because she spent all her husband's money and everybody else's money in the process. Brothers and sisters, this man was so out of touch with reality, he was in big trouble. And so he called his estates general, he called the French legislative body together, and he called the clergy, and he called the nobility, and he called the commoners together. Now, what they used to do before this time in 1789, whenever they called the legislative assembly together, the parliament together, they had this real interesting voting system. Each of these classes or estates or groups were given one vote each. One vote each class, each estate. So if there happened to be assembled there 50 of the clergy, they got one vote. If there happened to be 150 of the nobility sitting there, they just got one vote. If there were 300 or 400 commoners, didn't matter, you just get one vote. So you discuss an issue, you talk about it, you thrash it out, and you say, righto, time to vote. What do you clergy think? Yep, absolutely. What about you, nobility? Totally agree with the clergy. Yep, we're with that. What about you, commoners? No, we don't agree with that. Well, I'm sorry, you're outvoted 2-1. And that's all that happened, brothers and sisters. And the commoners in France made up 90% of the population. Your tradespersons, your artisans, and all of that. They made up 90%. And every time there was a vote, it was always the clergy and the nobility ganging up 2-1. Sorry, you're outvoted. That's how they ran things in France. Well, Louis is in trouble. He knows that the common people are starting to rumble. He can hear a great big train coming down the track. He knows he's got to do something to placate the commoners. So what he did, stupid man, what he did was he said, I know what I'll do. I'm in trouble. We're going to have a revolution. My financial advisor said, stop spending. I can't stop spending. So I've got to do something else. So he said, now look what I'll do is I'll do this. He said, now you commoners, I'll give you 600 votes. And I will give the combined clergy and nobility 600 votes. See what he did? He said, you can't be stalemate, you can't be railroaded. He said, at least you're in for a chance. You've got a fighting chance in here when you start sorting out the problems. And the stupid man withdrew and just sat back and waited to see what would happen. Well, the commoners went, okay, we got 600. You guys have got 600. So the commoners went across to the nobility and they said, you can't possibly accept what this fellow is doing in France. Could you? Have a look at him over there. He's living in a palace that's got 700 rooms. He's spending, look at the opulence that you cut. And the nobility said, actually, we don't like it either. So they said, well, come over. So a few of the nobility came over. Oh, now there's 605. And they went across to the clergy and they said, you're supposed to be men of God. You possibly can't accept this. And they went, some of the clergy, no, we didn't like it either. They went across. Now there's 610. Louis, you are in big trouble because now the vote is against you as a king. And so, brothers and sisters, he called. He convened because he's in trouble. He convened on May the 5th, 1789, at the Palace of Versailles. In a desperate attempt to stave off civil unrest, he called them together. He called from the political heavens and he said, come up, assemble together, and we've got to sort out this mess. Because he knows something's going to happen. He didn't know it was going to be a revolution. Well, brothers and sisters, what happened? They got these votes as the clergy and the nobility started to join together with the commoners. And what happened? The Estates General voted to make itself a permanent national assembly. And so what they said, these commoners that had 600 votes and these nobility and clergy that went across the other side with them, they said, all right, we're staying here now. We've been assembled. We've been called up like a great cloud. We're staying here and we're not moving until we write a new constitution for France. We're not moving. Well, Louis pulled his troops out. And then the commoners pulled out a whole band of rabble-risers and they called themselves the National Guard. And then 2 months later, they stormed the Bastille. Oh, Louis is in big trouble. But they stayed there and they said, we're not moving until we write a new constitution for France. Well, this old guy comes in and he says, get out. I'm locking up. And they said, why? And he said, because the king wants to make a presentation. So get out, the lot of you. So they did. They walked out. They had to go somewhere to write this new constitution for France. So they went across the street and went into the tennis court. So went into the indoor tennis court. And in history, they call that the Tennis Court Proclamation. So there they are, brothers and sisters. There's a bit of the clergy. There's a few of the aristocracy. And there's a whole pile of commoners. They stood on their feet. And it was a great shaking in France. What an amazing thing. So in 1789, the new National Assembly was published. And there was a decree proclaiming liberty of opinions, religious and political. And the property of the exiled Huguenots that had been unsold at that time, they said it should be restored to their rightful heirs. You know, brothers and sisters, when you read in Revelation chapter, I hear Brother Frank and I could just feel for him. In fact, I feel like I'm talking like him. Do I sound like Frank? You know, Canadians, Australians come to Canada and you've got such a very nice, easy on the ear roll of your words. And Australians pick up that twang. Is it a twang? Oh, I suppose it's a twang. They pick up a twang. I don't hear many Canadians coming across to Australia in a matter of months picking up g'day or how's it going? Oh, so I in my ears, I sound like Frank. Do I? I don't look like him, though, do I? But, you know, Brother Frank says, and we all feel this, you read the Bible sometimes and you just get quivers sometimes about the way some verses are put there just to show that Almighty God's hand penned these words and so that we can be thrilled that we're able to read his message. This verse here, brothers and sisters, look, Louis called them up from heaven, from the political heavens, and in a great cloud he assembled the Estates General. It turned on him because he did what he did with respect to giving them the votes. But look, verse 13, and the same hour was there a great earthquake. That was the French Revolution. And the tenth part of the city, that was a tenth part of Europe, that was France, fell. And in the earthquake, there were slain of men 7,000. Now you have a look at your margin. If you've got a margin, you have a look at what your margin says. It doesn't say there were 7,000 men slain. What does it say? Pardon me? Slain of men, it says. Anybody else got something else? Names of men. You know, brothers and sisters, there were 7,000 titles. Now, 7 is the number of perfection. So when the French Revolution came, the perfection of titles was absolutely obliterated. Nobody in France, when the people stood on their feet, were allowed to have a title. You couldn't call yourself a marquis. You didn't dare call yourself a duke. You didn't dare call yourself a count. You know what you called yourself? Citizen. Everybody was a citizen. No titles were permitted in the French Revolution. What an amazing thing. The Bible just says in the French Revolution, they obliterated titles of men. Even King Louis was not allowed to be addressed by sire or your majesty. Even he was stripped of his title. To be an aristocrat, brothers and sisters, in this time, to have a title or a name in this time meant death. You daren't call yourself a count or a duke or a marquis. Even if you were suspected to have a title, you were gone. A breath of opposition. I mean, look, we were living in the French Revolution. You just say, watch out for Harold. Be careful of Helen. Watch out for Mary. That's all I had to say. And you had your head chopped off. That's how bad it was in the French. Nobody had a title, brothers and sisters, in that particular era. And it got so bad that as this great train, this great swell of these people in the French Revolution, it got so bad that they had this thing called the Reign of Terror in 1793 to 1794. And everybody, I mean, the guillotine was working overtime. They could not keep up with the guillotine. They were taking people out in leaky boats and sinking them in the rivers and in the oceans. They were just bloodlusting everywhere. And in 1793, King Louis the 16th and his wife Marie Antoinette got their heads chopped off, and the world looked at it and were absolutely overawed. They couldn't believe what was happening in France, and they were fearful for the ramifications that would sweep the world. The scene, brothers and sisters, is set for the opening of Revelation chapter 16. This is the scene for the opening of Revelation 16. Now, I'm in a dilemma. I've got 10 minutes to go. No, it's 9, actually. Actually, I don't know. I think we should finish early and pick this up. No, 5 minutes will be fine. We'll do 5 minutes. That's okay. I'll do 5 minutes. I was just doing some mental gymnastics to see whether I could do anything worthwhile in 5 minutes. Okay, Revelation chapter 16. The scene is set in Revelation chapter 16, brothers and sisters, for the opening of the seven vials. Now, on the screen here, we have a very interesting connection. Just picking up the threads of where we've been. We have been considering trumpet 5, which was the Saracens. We have been considering trumpet 6, which were the Turks in the first instance, and then judgment on the West, which was Revelation 11, and leading up to the great earthquake, which was the French Revolution. Now, the seventh trumpet was blasted toward the end of chapter 11, and we were given an overview of the seventh trumpet. Now, when we have a look at the French Revolution that we've just seen there, the connection is there, brothers and sisters. Behold, the second woe is past, and behold, the third woe cometh quickly. Well, the third woe is the seventh trumpet. And the seventh trumpet, which is the third woe, contains these seven vials. Now, we needed to have a look at vials 1 through to 5. These five vials are found in Revelation 16, and it's the French Revolution that we've just considered that actually forms a springboard, if you like, a platform to launch into vial number 1. Because in vial number 1, the angel pours out his vial upon the earth, and there was a grievous ulcer. And this ulcer started in France and just swept all the way through Europe. So what happened in Revelation 11... became the basis of the first vile angel to pour out his bowl upon the earth. And we'll see that as it transpires. Now, the interesting thing about the first five vials, which are in Revelation 16, is that these first five were poured out and they took 30 years. This was predominantly the work of Napoleon as he marched across Europe bringing judgment on Catholic Europe. 30 years from 1789, that's why the Revelation 11 and the Great Earthquake forms a platform for the beginning of the first vial in Revelation 16. And so from 1789 to 1820, you have these 30 years of the first five vials. Now here's a question, and we're going to answer this question, God willing, tomorrow. Why is it that the sixth vial, of which part we are in, why has the sixth vial, which commenced in 1820, why has it up till this point in time taken 188 years? Why, when all of those other five vials were accomplished in 30 years, why did God allow it to go on and on and on and still going on, and we're in the 188th year? Why? Oh, there is a reason for it. There is a political reason for it. There is a prophetic reason for it, and there is an exhortational reason for it to the brothers and sisters in Christ, which we will have, God willing, a look at tomorrow. Okay, flick through this. It's okay. Now, the vials begin, springboarded from the French Revolution, springboarded from Revelation chapter 11. The vials in Revelation 16, verses 1 to 11, the first five vials, started off, brothers and sisters, and the whole thrust of these vials would be judgment, and the first five would be Napoleon marching across Europe. So really, when you read the first five vials, God has in store that he is going to bring an end to an empire that had existed for over 1,000 years. So when we start in Revelation 16, God's intent is to remove an empire, the Holy Roman Empire, and he raised up a man of destiny, Napoleon. Now, I think this is remarkable, you see. Napoleon. I'm not going to say a lot about him, but he's a remarkable character, and he was a man raised up, and God used him as an instrument to bring an end to the Holy Roman Empire. And the French Revolution was the platform from which this man was going to... In fact, Napoleon was 20 when the French Revolution was raging. So as a teenager, Napoleon was watching the French Revolution coming. And at 20, as a man, he used the French Revolution as a platform to catapult him, he thought, to fame. But you know, brothers and sisters, the hand of God. Napoleon was born there. He was born in Corsica. He was a Corsican. Now, just before his birth, Corsica was owned by Italy. Corsica was Italian. And then the French came in and took Corsica. So Napoleon grew up absolutely detesting the French. He also grew up and he couldn't speak the language. And he also grew up, kinda, to 5'2". So you've got this little look at me. Now look, 5'2" is there, okay? Now you could imagine, could you see me sitting on a white horse? Now look, Napoleon, he's 5'2", he hates the French. He can't hardly speak the language. And 10 years before he comes in and becomes the first consul of France, 10 years before that, there were people in France cutting people's heads off because they did not want a dictator. They did not want an emperor. They said, we will never have any more kings, ever. 10 years later, a 5'2", hater of the French, who could hardly speak the French language, walks in and says, I'm your consul. You think that would have happened naturally, brothers and sisters? Absolutely not. There was the hand of Almighty God saying, I'm going to take that man and I'm going to use him and I'm going to bring him to bring an end to the Holy Roman Empire. So he was an heir to the revolution and he reorganized France and he conquered Europe and he would become the platform or a dominant feature. Now, we've only got time for this and that's good. This is working well. We've only got time for this and then we'll pick up the threads of this, God willing, tomorrow. Now, here is Revelation 16. You may not be able to see the text, but that doesn't matter. And we see, like Revelation 11, we see that Revelation 16 consummates or climaxes in a great earthquake. Unlike the second one of Revelation 11, which was the French Revolution, this is the greatest of all earthquakes. This is the coming of the Lord Jesus Christ in verse 18. Now, with the vials, you consider vials 1 to 5, and they're here. Our first vial, we read, is poured out upon the earth. I want to pick this up if we've got time tomorrow and show you that that was the Roman earth. So we're talking about Europe, predominantly the Holy Roman Empire. And the grievous sore was an ulcer that would not heal. Started in France and spread through Europe and you could not heal it because everybody got swept up with the spirit of revolution. And so all the revolutions that sprung therefrom came from the ideas of the French Revolution. Now, our second vial, we read in verse 3, the angel poured out his vial upon the sea, and the sea became blood, the blood of a dead man. You know what happens with the blood flowing through a dead man? Well, it doesn't flow. So the blood of a dead man is a congealed flow. So the sea, in some way, shape, or form, would be congealed. There would be no flow. There would be no movement on the sea. This was Nelson and the British blockade. Now, the third vial is poured out on the fountains or the rivers and fountains of waters. This was Napoleon's Alpine campaign where he went up to the areas of northern Italy and southern Switzerland where it's full of rivers and lakes and the like. This was the third vial in 1796. The fourth vial was poured out upon the sun in AD 805. This was Napoleon's campaign against the Austrians and particularly the capital of Austria, which was the capital of the Holy Roman Empire, Vienna. So he was going to pour out his vial upon the Son. And then the fifth vial, very much linked with the fourth, was poured out upon the seat of the beast. The Pope himself would not escape. And so Napoleon would deal with the Catholicism. And that was in 1809. That was the fifth vial. God willing, tomorrow we want to spend, we're almost there. Tomorrow, I've just given you a very brief, that's very brief. We usually spend about 2 or 3 hours going through those five. I might just say, Brother David has got a, if anyone wants it, you may not, I don't blame you after this, but if anybody wants a copy, we've got a copy of this study where we go through this in detail, and we'll pop that on the stick. Yeah, USB, flash drive, power drive, pen drive. All right. Now, God willing, tomorrow, brothers and sisters, we're going to spend all of our study on a portion of the sixth vial. The sixth angel poured out his vial upon the great river Euphrates. That's in verse 12. And, of course, just to finish the chart, the seventh vial was poured into the air. These are the thunder judgments. These are that which will take place after the coming of Christ and before the setting up of the millennium. Now, tomorrow, we will spend all of our study on the sixth vial. And what we'll find tomorrow, brothers and sisters, and I hope it works out this way, and I've planned it that it might do so, not only will we see tomorrow some absolutely fascinating facets of history, but I want to bring our studies to a conclusion and draw out some very, very powerful exhortations to you and me as we live in these last days and as we wait for the coming of the Lord Jesus Christ. So we look forward to that study tomorrow. Thank you, brothers and sisters.